Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solera Report. Today we are going to talk about one of my recently discovered new favorite things to talk about, which is art. And we're going to do that with one of my, albeit the favorite, mentor and guide in this newly discovered realm of art, Nina Hein, who is the writer, editor, and the mastermind behind Food for the Soul. And today we are going to talk about learning about art. So who better than my personal mentor and guide and wealth of knowledge, Nina Hein. Welcome. Great to talk to you again.
Hi, it's great to talk to you, even though it's a little bit hard to talk after that wonderful introduction. So let's just jump into what we are going to be talking about.
Excellent.
So our conversation is actually part of the larger framework for an quarterly issue of wrap-up at Solera Report, which is going to be entitled Loving Art. We are devoting the whole issue to this subject, which is slightly removed from finance and political news that usually fill the pages there, but maybe not that far, which is why we are talking about art and education in this particular conversation. I have the honor of being a guest editor of the art part of that issue. And you and I would talk about what does it mean loving art and loving education and how the two things connect. I think that I'm well placed to make some comparisons because I was born and raised in Europe like you are, but I have spent half of my time in the United States. So I can just compare the two worlds. And I feel that I have a unique perspective on how different art, or how differently art is being treated by the Europeans and Americans. Obviously, this is generalizing because it depends when and how and what place. But I have a feeling that in the United States, fine art, you know, the art with a capital A, if you like, is treated, or art education is treated as something that is additional to education, very kind of elitist, available both through access to art and understanding of art and education about art. It seems to be kind of mostly reserved for people who are affluent and educated. And in Europe, the access to the same art is much more, well, let's say democratic, even though this is probably not the right word, but much more casual and much more populist. And I observe it when I go, you know, between Europe and United States, and I look at museums and I look at what happens at schools and I talk to people who have children. And that kind of leads me to a question that I would have for you, a person who A, lives in Europe and is a father, and what do you think? What is your, you obviously have been to United States as well. So what is your opinion on this?
Well, when you and I went on our first journey together through a museum, which really was an adventure, it was here in my home country in the Netherlands. It was in the Rijksmuseum. And we went to this exhibition from Johannes Vermeer. And I knew absolutely zero about art. I think I know maybe 0.1%. I'm starting to learn right now, thanks to you. And when you took me to the Rijksmuseum, which I had never been to before with my family and several of the Solera team members, it was quite an experience. And there was so much that I didn't know about Dutch history, about who I am as a Dutchman. And there was so much to learn about the Dutch old masters and the whole context around it that was just fascinating. And of course, staring at these paintings by themselves is quite a journey, because some of it, especially the more realistic paintings, are quite self-explanatory. You can look at them and you can like them because they're a very accurate depiction of some kind of scene from the past, from several hundred years ago. But to have the context around it, especially with Vermeer and his light effects, and to hear that from you was very eye-opening. And that really put me on a trajectory of starting to like art. I wouldn't say love art yet, but then several years after that, I think 1 or 2 years after that, you and I went to several museums in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
and they had a wonderful collection. The Barnes was just incredible. And you showed me around and you told me all about these different paintings and all about the painters behind them and their stories. And it was a personal guide and it was an adventure. And I really enjoyed that. And that set me up on this trajectory of learning more about it, which I, growing up in Europe, didn't really joyfully do. It was definitely done in high school where you were exposed to museums. But so this is
exactly that was my question. When you were growing up in, you know, right heart of Europe,
mm-hmm.
how much of the art education, and I don't mean, you know, finger painting for preschoolers, but right. you know, art education, how much of this happens to you?
Right. Yeah, and it's good you make that distinction.
Field trips?
So we did do field trips. But it was more the way I would see it is crammed down our throat. So you were dropped in a museum as 15, 16 year old guy with this group of friends, and you were just let loose without any guidance, without uh-huh. somebody you could relate to who could bring down the stories to something that would relate to a young teenager and that would give the proper context around it. So I would say that if you do it right, and I think there is a way of doing it right, of making these stories entertaining, of putting it in a broader historical context, of what it means for you to be Dutch and have this wealth of history of all these Dutch old masters, that would bring it to life. And I think there's a real opportunity there for this generation to teach the new generation about art and about learning about art. So done the proper way, there is a tremendous opportunity. Here in Europe, it's definitely... We're spending a lot of time in high school teaching kids, but I think there's a, especially in this area, there's an opportunity to really do things better. Now, I don't have any experience about the United States, so I'm curious, what is that like? What do kids in the States generally learn about art in the sort of high school period?
Well, first of all, I think that there, in the States, there's a big divide between public schools that are usually underfunded
mm-hmm.
And do not offer any art education classes from grade 1 to 12 because this is considered a luxury for which there is very little money. If there is money for so-called, you know, arts, it usually gets assigned to or often gets assigned to like music lessons, meaning that there is money allocated to buy instruments, to have a school orchestra. I don't see that many field trips of children any age, you know, not elementary, not middle and not high school, in museums when I go to the United States. In fact, I was kind of struck, I mean, I've lived here for decades, and I was always struck at the museums that I do not see what I see everywhere in Europe, literally everywhere. You know, it doesn't matter if it's going to be Spain or Poland or Prague or France or whatever. I do not see school trips, you know, groups of kids of any age. Whereas in literally, I have seen at La Reina Sofia in Madrid, I've seen children that were maybe 3 years old, 4 years old, maximum, meaning preschoolers.
Really?
Yes. And obviously, I routinely see school trips of, you know, middle school or high schoolers, very often from other countries, meaning you go to the Louvre and you see a school trip from, I don't know, Germany or Poland or Italy.
Mm-hmm.
They are taken on a field trip to, let's say, Paris. And one of the things that they do on that field trip is going to the Louvre. But going back to the United States, all I'm saying is that there is a big divide between the public schools that are underfunded and therefore they don't have in their programs much of the art education, and the private schools where this exists quite well, where you actually have art education as part of, you know, whatever the school program is there, and they do go on field trips. Obviously, private schools are funded by parents who pay the fee, so there is a budget for it. So there is this divide, and obviously that continues later on, that you have what I'm observing, which means that the fine art is considered something that is only for the people who are very well educated and affluent. And that's very sad because you go to Europe and you see that it doesn't cost that much money
Right.
to have a field trip. It doesn't cost that much money to have some kind of familiarity with art if you have restructured maybe the educational program. In other words, I see, that this is done with public education funds in Europe, and somehow it happens. But it's also, to me, this is also a state of mind. And that's what we're talking about today, that I think that this is extremely sad that there is this belief that art, again, the fine art, that this is something that is elitist and this is something that is only for the chosen few rather than this being something that is available. And I think that the educational of society or a parent starts at the young age. In other words, if you do not expose your children at a young age to fine art, then they will probably never find their way to the museum.
Right.
I had a question for you because you actually have young children. So my question is, do you, now that you have been kind of infected with the bug of loving art by your trips to the museums, do you do something or do you plan to do something with your very young children? I understand that they're young, but do
Right.
you plan to kind of expose them to art somehow?
Absolutely. And they're just so just to finalize the budget side of things, when I went to London last year, you told me that I should definitely see a number of museums. And then, of course, that raises the question, what's all of that going to cost? And then I learned that London, actually, all of these museums in Great Britain are absolutely free to the public. So that is a perfect model, and it really lowers the barrier of entry for people to just go and see if they enjoy it. And with kids, honestly, you just never know what they like and what they don't like. So having that low barrier of entry just means you can go into a museum, see if you like it, and just walk around. And if they don't, you just go to the next. And this is what I'm trying to instill in my kids right now, is just I bring them to these museums. I try and teach them about nature. I try to teach them about art, but in a very playful way. So I don't tell them what's right and what's wrong. I just walk around and I say, what do you see? Staring at these pictures, what do you see? What do you like? And for example, my daughter really likes horses. So whenever she sees a horse in these paintings, she instantly just looks at that and she resonates with that. And that's perfect. So I try and do that. And then when you and I were at the Rijksmuseum, I brought home this book, which is so this is Nijntje, which is a Dutch bunny for children. And this little rabbit is going around and looking at all the Vermeer paintings and then telling stories. And when I read this to my kids, they ask questions about the paintings and they say, what's that lady doing with the guitar? Or what's that lady doing with the jewelry, which looks like pearls, but I learned from you aren't actually pearls. So surrounding ourselves with these little books that just tell them these stories about what we see in the museums, and then trying to make that something that's alive and it resonates with them, whatever it is. Not for me to tell them what they like. It's not for me to tell them what's right and what's wrong. I definitely plan on doing that, Nina. And as soon as they get a little older, you can get into more details and maybe you can get a guide or a tour. What do you think is the right way of progressing into this? And what did that look like for you, by the way? How did
Well,
how
actually, we can just name things that you and I, we can kind of brainstorm some ideas for, for the salary readers, for anybody who's or anybody who's actually watching this video. The kind of easy ways of bringing art education to the young people without, or to people in general, without making it something extremely expensive or difficult. So I think you put a finger on the first one, which is what I believe in, is that if you surround the kids with art and books from birth, which is exactly what you have behind you. You have books and you have a beautiful painting just behind you. Those kids are growing up with this. They are not, nobody's cramming it down their throats, but they are growing up with art because that painting is in the house.
Right.
They may ignore it the rest, you know, all the time, but inevitably this is part of their lives. And it doesn't always even have to be a real painting, meaning an original like yours. It could be even a reproduction of something that got picked up for, you know, 10 bucks at the museum, as long as it's on the walls and it's there.
And that takes away the whole argument of why do I need to learn about art? Because it's just ingrained in their DNA. They always saw mom and dad talk about art, surround themselves with art. And that initially, if you do that from the start, it just ingrains it into their DNA. And it also, what I love about books or paintings is they tell the stories of the lives of the people in that house. So whenever you go into somebody's house, an old house, some house that has been in the family for generations, especially in the United States, you find this a lot. These beautiful homes that have bookshelves that are meters wide, meters tall, and they just tell stories about what these people like to read and what they were interested in. And then you see the paintings on the wall and you can ask them about it, and they can tell stories. So it brings it to life. And that's what I love about art. And when you look at this one, for example, so I brought this one out for the interview today. This painting was gifted to me by my grandparents, and it tells a story of what they did in life. They worked on boats. They sailed up the Rhine. And then my grandfather worked in the harbor to connect all the boats to the wall. Like he would work on these little boats, get the ropes, and then tie them to the shores. And this painting tells that story of my family, which is why it's very dear to me. And this is not a Picasso. This is not a Monet. This is not a Rembrandt. And it's never going to sell for that price. But it doesn't matter, because to me, it's very dear. On the other side, this one, which is a more abstract painting. Now, you will not know this painter, but that is my little daughter. She created that one, and it's just a blend of colors. And I just absolutely love it. And she was very proud when she created it. And she said, "Daddy, this is for you." And it's perfect. It doesn't matter that it's just a blend of pictures, because this is her little creation, and I want to stimulate that.
Let me give you an idea to go further. If your daughters like making art, whatever art you're making, first of all, it's a good idea for parents to be making art with them when they're younger, and then they can do it with their friends. But you can take it one step further, because then you can have them work with you on framing the art, which is fun. You know, you choose the mat, you choose the frame, you choose the glass, then you attach, you know, you hammer the hanging on the back, then you choose the place where you hang it. The whole process of actually kind of nobilitating whatever they have created into a painting that is similar to what you find in a museum. It's very tactile, it's fun, and it's memorable. It's a memory that will stay for them, you know, as a memory of childhood could stay for the rest of their lives. Something that they did together with their parents that was actually transforming, you know, something that was an activity of using paint or whatever into actually a work of art.
Right.
They will never look at the art on the walls the same way after they went through this process.
I think that's a brilliant idea. And it reaffirms the value of it. It's not just a throwaway
painting.
It
nobilitates you somehow.
Yes. Yes, I do like that. I do like that very much.
Right.
I will go through that process.
Or you can do it. If they don't make it themselves, I think it's a better way. But if not, you can. If you go to the museum and you pick up a postcard or, you know, reproduction, they can do the same thing. They do their own framing for their own room. They can create when they get bigger. You know, yours are a little bit too young. But when they become like middle schoolers or high schoolers, they can also create a gallery wall, which means basically, you know, a wall that is dedicated, and then they can put on everything that they pick on at the flea market, at the museum, you know, any images that they like, and create their own composition.
Are there any painters or styles of painting or periods in history that you would say are a good point to start with younger children, and then as they progress, do you move to different painters or different styles?
I don't think so. We always think, oh well, because pop art is so much easier because it's bright colors and simple shapes, like, you know, King Herring or, you know, Warhol, whatever, that this is easier. Not necessarily. Because if your daughter, for example, likes horses, she might enjoy Van Dyck more than pop art. This is not necessarily how it works in people's brains, even young people.
Right.
So I wouldn't do that. And also because then you're creating this kind of elitist dichotomy that, you know, old masters is only for, you know, art historians and very, very rich people who have castles. And then pop art is something that is for everybody else, which is what is being promoted a lot in the 20th and 21st century, that somehow, you know, this democratization of art means that, you know, pop art or, you know, ready-mades or any of the contemporary art is accessible and everything else is only, you know, for old people or very elitist. And I tend to disagree, which is what I write in my articles a lot.
Where do you think that comes from? Why do you think that that's being promoted that way?
Well, I think part of it is historical because, you know, collecting old masters was always a kind of reserved to people who were very rich and very educated and, you know, like old English aristocracy. That's one thing. But there is more kind of maybe sinister threat to it, where we have an interview with a French intellectual called Aude de Keyros, which is going to be part of the Loving Art wrap-up issue, where she has done an interview where she talks about what happened after the Second World War with kind of promotion of contemporary art as a kind of a weapon against during the Cold War between East and West. It's a very interesting point of view. She has a very politicized point of view that many people might disagree with, but at least it's a very interesting take on the 20th century art and the fact that culture in general is being kind of dumbed down. Some of it is spontaneous because it's easier to understand a pop art image maybe than Rembrandt, but on the other hand, maybe it's more complex than we think. So I would refer everybody to this interview, which is going to be part of our issue, if you want to kind of delve into the political aspects of this democratization of art. There is definitely democratization of art just because of the internet in general, right? The accessibility of art, you know, it's people see many more art images than they used to see, let's say 50, 70, 80 years ago, just because, you know, before that you had to have an access to an art book and now you can just see it on your cell phone. So there's many aspects to it, but it doesn't mean that we as parents or family members who have younger people in the family, we have to agree with that. I have several ideas and we can just share what I think, how we can start, because I think it's never too late, how we can start to promote art education in simple ways. So I can just name a couple of things, that a couple of ideas that I had, but
let's pause here for a second, Nina, and I want to ask you this fundamental question, which I think in part we've already answered, but why should one learn about the arts or practice them yourself, maybe from a pedagogical standpoint?
Again, the answer is there's many answers to that. You know, you and I had this conversation a long time ago in one of our videos about the fact that if you do not know anything about fine art, and again, I'm not talking about, just the simple popular icons, but fine art in general, that lack of knowledge may come and bite you back decades later, because if someone actually becomes part of the either financial or intellectual elite, meaning someone may not be exposed to art at 15, but at 55, this person might be a successful business person, or might be a successful teacher, or might be a successful investor or a celebrity. And all these people, once they become very successful and therefore affluent, they will discover, sometimes in a very kind of brutal way, that in order to keep up with the people that they are exposed to, famous people, celebrities, very rich business people, they will need to be familiar with art, and I'm talking art with a capital A, because all these peoples, the elites all over the world, sooner or later start collecting and investing in art. And we're talking arts that is worth millions, not art that is worth
Right.
almost nothing. So in order not to feel, because it's easier to acquire a nice car and nice clothes, but it's harder to acquire at 55
Yes.
the knowledge of art that comes easy enough so that you could hold a conversation with someone that you care to have a nice conversation with. So there's kind of like self-interest, I would say, that I would promote, that if you want to get ahead in life, then it's better to know something about art. And this is something that is probably important to explain to teenagers, meaning the people who are they are very likely to kind of dismiss learning about paintings and art and whatever, because some of them may think it's fun, Van Gogh and so on. But some of them may say, well, I don't need to know about it. I'm going to be a computer scientist or something, and I really don't care about it. I'm going to the army or whatever. And these are the people, the young people, the teenagers, who probably need to be at least told that to get ahead in life, they may need to know something about art.
Yes. And it's part of who we are as human beings. We've always
Ah, that's
made
another
art.
one.
We've
Go
always,
ahead.
yeah, we've always captured art, wall paintings in caves thousands of years ago to capture the stories of those times and to express who we are and what was on our mind those in those days. And that has progressed and we've become more sophisticated at doing that. We're not painting on caves anymore. We're painting with specific pigments of paint, and but the stories are the same. They're the stories of our time, and they capture those stories for later generations to understand and to enjoy. So if we strip somebody from understanding these past stories, we strip them of an understanding of who they are. For example, me not knowing about the Dutch masters, that's part of who I am. That's part of the world around me. I didn't know that, but part of that puzzle was just missing, and I didn't even realize that. So I think there's another very good reason to learn about art, especially the art that we're surrounded by. But what about the art that we create ourselves? So what about kids expressing themselves, learning about different kinds of arts, drawing, painting, these kind of things? Do you think that that is crucial? It's part and parcel to their development as holistic human beings as well? How do you see that?
Well, definitely there is a kind of, in let's say, even psychology, a theory of art as therapy, which was kind of developed in relation to adults, but I think it applies to anybody at any age. Then that both communing with art, meaning going and looking at art, and I don't mean through a smartphone, but just directly. And making art is something that is therapeutical at any age. For children, is because they naturally gravitate to that and develops their all their skills, which is why there is some kind of art that is taught at schools, finger painting at preschool and then making some drawings maybe at some schools, which is great because it's an eye and hand coordination and it calms everybody down and allows them to express in images something that they cannot express in words. It is obviously used a lot in psychotherapy or family therapy for people who have been traumatized, both from children and adults. But that goes beyond that because it's also something that is therapy for all of us for various circumstances. Even if we hadn't been traumatized, spending a couple of hours looking at art calms us all down or gives us more positive feelings than we had. You and I have experienced that when we went to the museum. We felt better after that
Yes.
without doing anything. We're just walking around and looking at paintings and deciding which ones we like. So that is the aspect that is, everybody knows about it, kind of anecdotally. We know, yes, art is fun and it's therapy, but we do not do enough. We know that if we're going to go for a run, there is going to be dopamine and serotonin released, and we're going to feel better after a physical exercise.
Right.
But there's not enough of statements by various people to say you can also have that kind of feeling of feeling good after looking at art or making art.
It's raising, I mean, the way I see it is you get a taste for what raising yourself to a literally like a higher vibration, what that feels like. It's like listening to a masterpiece by a Vivaldi, for example, and understanding what he's trying to tell you. Not just listening to it, but getting the full context around it. Or looking at a phenomenal painting that you really enjoy and having the context around it. It's a taste of what a higher culture can achieve, and you can step into that, and you can step out of the swiftly deteriorating culture around us into that higher mind, into that higher world, and channel some of that. So I definitely, I appreciate that there's a therapeutic element to that. So what happens then with the swift digitalization of everything around us and NFTs and all of that stuff, and
Well, I have a photo that I sent you and that we're gonna place as part of this video. This is the photo at the Rijksmuseum. There's a beautiful Rembrandt, huge famous painting, The Night Watch, and there's a bunch of kids. All of them are next to this painting, but they are looking at their smartphones, not looking at the painting, and they
Right.
couldn't care less.
Right.
It could be wallpaper, and
That was me 15
this
years
is the
ago, Nina.
danger. What?
That was me 15 years ago. Was
Yes.
probably me.
So this is what we are saying is, well, but it's not only you, it's everybody, and now the world has accelerated. So, but there's a trick as a parent, there's a trick that I would suggest that sometimes it's hard for the young kids, especially, to enjoy a proper fine art museum just because the paintings are placed fairly high. Not at their eye level sometimes, and also because they are sometimes dark. Like, if you're gonna take the kids to the Rijks, you have to lift them because they're not gonna see it very well, and it's also a lot of them are dark. But if, for example, as a parent, you go on a trip, even to a different country, choose fine art museums or art museums or museums that are might be really pleasing to, they are still highbrow, but pleasing to kids. So an example that I always use is the Musée d'Armée in Paris, which is Les Invalides, where there is a tomb of Napoleon, and there are some, artifacts from various Napoleonic wars. It's a fun museum for anybody at any age. There is a museum in London called the Wallace Collection. The hall downstairs is nothing.
Yes.
Medieval armors.
I went there based on your recommendation, Ian, and that was just, it was
Isn't it
phenomenal.
fun?
It was a lot of fun. And exactly, it was fun. They got a good collection of paintings too, but it was fun. And that is certainly one that you don't need a lot of education before going to really help you understand what's going on, because you see all these medieval knights and you see swords from ancient India and from Persia, and they got a
Yes,
whole
but all
collection.
of it is fine arts. All I'm trying to say is that is I think it's not enough for the parents to think that if they are going to take them to a local science museum, you know, the one that the kids kind of do a little physics experiments, you know, chemistry experiments, and this is enough. This is fun, and it's about sciences, and it's extremely interactive and designed for kids, but it doesn't teach them to like fine art. It's not highbrow enough.
What describe that better for the ones listening who don't understand what highbrow is?
Well,
what
this,
does that
this
mean?
Is the American slant, because in Europe you don't have that much this dichotomy, because the culture with a capital C is available in any mid-sized European city everywhere, because the buildings are beautiful and they have a wonderful architecture. Museums are free or, you know, not very expensive. Children go on field trips. So the culture and it also exists in people's homes. Whereas in the United States, it's much harder because most of the buildings are beyond ugly. Maybe not that much on the East Coast, but if you the farther west you go, the uglier they are. So you're not gonna get much reward when looking at buildings. Museums are expensive and considered elitist, and it's the whole production to go to them. And there is not much art education, you know, art, you know, fine art. So in the States, you do kind of differentiate very often, at least I can see that I can differentiate the highbrow or fine art or, you know, culture and something that is just very kind of, you know, let's go and look at things that are fun, you know.
More playful.
Playful, yes. Which obviously they have place in kids' life as well, you know, Disneyland and everything. Of course, this is wonderful, but it should not be the only type of imagery that they look at, because if they are never exposed to it when they're young, it's going to be very hard uphill battle to expose them at 40. It's just, that's how it is. If you haven't been exposed to nature as a kid, you know, never walked in a forest with the sun coming through the trees and the birds singing, you're not going to start liking it at 45, because this will be alien to you. It will just not be fun.
So the what you were just describing, the deterioration of the quality and the beauty of the buildings that we see as you go further west in the United States, is that a symptom of a deteriorating culture with a capital C? Or is that just...
No, it's a history of United States, because, you know, United States has been kind of settled by the people coming from Europe from, you know, 16th century onwards and progressively moving to the West. There's many reasons why the European type of culture has not been transplanted or transplanted less the further west you were going, for historical, economic, and sociological reasons that are kind of obvious. But that's how it is, you know. A large chunk of United States is populated with cities that are built, you know, as kind of wooden shacks with a lot of advertising. There hasn't been the time in, let's say, 18th or 19th century to build the kind of architecture that we consider now pretty in, let's say, Paris, right?
Right.
This is how it is. You know, America is not the only, or United States is not the only place like this. You know, there's other parts of the both American continents and parts of Asia. Well, Asia is completely different, but Australia, let's say. So this, it is what it is. I'm not particularly criticizing, or, you know, we know why it is. But all I'm saying is that because there is less of the kind of fine art and culture available just by living the daily life, then maybe a bit more effort needs to be made to bring that kind of thing, making it more available. But it definitely starts, because we're talking out, the topic that we have here is education. So if we're talking about education, and it doesn't matter if it's in the States or in Europe or Australia or wherever, It has to start young. It should be kind of seamless. You have said something that was very interesting. Maybe you can talk more about it, about when you walk with your children and you look at some artworks, whatever it is, and you ask them questions. So what questions you ask them?
So I will ask them what they see, because some of these paintings are very elaborate. They're very detailed, very realistic paintings where you see not just the horse, but it's the rider, it's the forest around them. There's a building in the back, and there's whatever, there's a road, and there's all sorts of details coloring in this painting. And with some of them, the longer you look at them, the more you see, the more you discover. And I'm just curious what these unbiased little eyes, what they see in the painting.
And what is the feedback you get? What do they say back?
Well, it's mostly these obvious things, such as the horse with my daughter. She really likes horses, and whenever she sees a horse in there, she will cling on to that. Outside of horses, it's people. So she will ask, why is the girl crying? You know, she will read the painting and say, why is she crying? Or why is she carrying a little bag? Why is the bag blue? You know, these kind of questions. And I think that's a blessing to go at these paintings with such an unbiased view. I really think it is a blessing. So
the more why and how they ask, and not just stating the obvious that something is whatever it is, the better. I think in general in life, people do not ask enough about why something, you know, they tell you that, you know, a dog has bitten a cat, but they never ask why that happened,
why?
How. It just states the fact, but never yes. Go look beyond that. And I just look at it sometimes and it just drives me nuts, because I say, why not make one more step further? So that's obviously for kids, but you know, I also think that art education is a lifelong process. Here's, I will selfishly kind of guide everybody to my Food for the Soul articles, which are both things. A, they are called, the whole website is called Food for the Soul, because I think that art is therapy and kind of makes people happier when you learn about art or look at art, because we have enough stuff going on in our lives regardless.
Yes.
But also because then throughout life, and that's something that you have touched upon, you can learn about works of art in a larger context, meaning not only, okay, well, that was the painting of the boats, but you can learn about the history of the Netherlands, or you can learn about the Hanseatic cities, or maybe the maritime roots of the wealth of the country that you live in, or the continuity or importance of knowing where you come from, meaning your heritage, because that kind of informs the decisions that people, the contemporary people, make in their careers or in their politics.
Yes.
And you can do it through art. You can do it through a book, of course, but you can do it through art as well, no?
Yes, absolutely. And one example of that, for example, when we speak about the Netherlands, you still have this geographical divide between more Protestantism in the north and Catholics or Catholicism in the south. And when you and I were looking at these paintings in the United States that were done by some of the old Dutch masters, you saw a transition throughout time after the Reformation that really affected which kind of paintings were ordered to be created and who ordered them. For example, when the church would order them, they were very lavish and they were very big and they were all these theological, very romanticized, extravagant images. And then, you know, contrary to that, you had this whole period of Vermeer. It was just day-to-day situations. Somebody in the kitchen with a pot of tea. You know, this kind of situations, or milk. You know, very day-to-day situations. And to hear how these theological themes and developments play into which kind of paintings you see more prevalent in a specific chronological time period is just fascinating. And it helps us understand who we are. So outside of understanding who we are, feeding our souls with art. And then, as you've described, if you want to really get ahead in life, you need to understand art. Say you take in all three of these arguments and you're convinced, Nina, where do you start and how do you learn? Do you go to Wikipedia? Do you order a tour guide? Do you order books? What do you do? Because not everybody has access to Nina Hein.
Yeah. Well, actually, through the website, anybody, because the website is free, you can just
click. That's right. Food for the soul, everybody.
Yeah, exactly. But other than that, I think that if you are a parent, or at least, you know, a member of the family, and you want to do something to bring some art in, you can start anywhere. You know, you can go to a flea market and literally walk through a flea market and look at the paintings that are there. A, you could maybe acquire a nice reproduction or even an original painting for less than $100. I do it routinely. You know, you find an oil painting. If you negotiate hard enough, you could probably buy a small oil painting that you can actually touch because it's yours. So you can touch, you can play with the texture. You can look at beautiful frames or whatever. So you can even go to a flea market if you don't want to go to a museum. But I would really highly recommend going to museums. Most of them, even if they are not free, there is at least one day in a month when they are free. And not feel intimidated. I see that a lot. I don't see it in Europe, but I do see it in the United States, that somehow the museums, art museums, feel intimidating to a lot of people, that they just, well, because I don't know much about art, then I'm not going to go because all these people know much more than I do, which is false. Mm-hmm. You do not need to know anything about art.
Right.
To enjoy things, you just look at it and it's like, well, I like this, I don't like this. I mean, when you went with me to a museum in the States, of all the impressionist art that we saw on the walls, the one that spoke to you the best was not an impressionist painting. It was right. Done by Giorgio de Chirico, which is surrealist.
Yes.
And discover that this is something that speaks to you best. Well, you're not going to discover it by looking at a book or scrolling through the cell phone, because you just need to be, that's why they use the word communing. You need to be in front of something. Art is a direct experience, and especially for a sculpture, of course, but even for a painting, you need to stand in front of it and also see many of them on the walls, which is hard to do unless you go to a museum. But I would just recommend, just for the hell of it, go with a family.
And bring a friend and bring somebody you can chat about.
And just, the food is always fantastic at museums. Art museums always have good restaurants with fantastic food. You know, their sandwich is always better than any sandwich at any fast food. They have interesting, it doesn't have to be a painting. Sometimes it's fabric. Victoria and Albert Museum, for example, in London, is full of galleries that have nothing to do with paintings. There are, you know, gold boxes, jewelry, there is clothing, there is fashion, there is weapons, there's millions of things. You can just choose, okay, I only like this, whatever it is. Ignore everything else and never, never feel intimidated. Something that it never even occurred to me growing up in Europe that art could be intimidating, because I kind of grew up with it. So it was just everywhere, the same way you have, you know, a frying pan and a bar of soap, right? So this is a bar of soap and a painting on the wall. You know, it's part of the everyday life. And then I come to the United States and people tell me, oh, no, I never go to a museum because I don't know anything about art, so I don't want to feel bad about it. And it, to me, it's just not the right approach. So that's why we're having this conversation, just to remind people that the barrier of entry is very low. You just go there and you like something or you hate it. Even if you hate something, okay, then you have something to hate. And you can have an argument why you hated this painting. You can criticize. We all love criticizing, gossiping, and dissing something. And it's as if, did you see this so-called sculpture, how ugly it was and how insane it is? Maybe you can just approach it from the negative way, but at least interact with it.
Yes. And it teaches you a lot about what you like and what you dislike. The other game that we always play when we go to these museums is which of all the paintings, in theory, would you like to take home if you could? And that just puts a whole nother angle where you're actively searching for which of these paintings do I like best? Which one, in theory, just to play the game, could I take home and hang in a very prominent place in my house on the wall to enjoy? And that it's a fun game because it puts you it gives you a little bit of ownership about your trip. It gives you a goal and you look around and you say, I like this one, but actually I like the one over there better. And then you talk about it and you say, why did you like this one? Why did it speak to you? And that was the fun. When I saw the Kiriko painting, the surrealistic painting, I didn't know why I liked it. And when you and I started to talk about why surrealism in the 20th century became so prevalent, I learned maybe why I like it better. And I just, it's still a mystery to me, but I remember very well seeing it for the first time. I was just captivated by it. I was like, what is this awkward thing, which is not as descriptive and detailed, but somehow it speaks to me and it reminds me of places that I've never been to. Like, it reminds me of memories I didn't know I have. It's a very,
exactly.
It's a very strange feeling. And in that, you learn a lot about your own emotions, about your own psychology. Like, it's a very fascinating topic. So that is fun. It is a lot of fun. But you should go out with a goal. You should go out with somebody to use as a soundboard to talk about and just learn about it and have fun. I guess that's the first and foremost thing. I wanted to ask you, when you were just talking about how in the United States, a lot of people are intimidated by these museums and related to elitist and think that it's not achievable for them to learn about and then dive into that world. Is that something that has always been the case, or were previous generations better at appreciating art and weaving culture into their everyday life, like 100 years ago or 200 years ago? What was it like back then? Do you know?
Well, historically, I think there has always been a great divide between the kind of culture of the East Coast, which was some kind of settled by people who came very often from very affluent, educated layers of the European societies, the ones who kind of came to New York and brought with them the art as well, right? And then obviously the settlers who maybe came later or went further west, which were those immigrants from, let's say, Ireland, Poland, Italy, and other impoverished parts of Europe who were immigrating because that was an economic immigration. They would be very often farmers, of course, and people who never had any habit of either collecting art or looking at art, and certainly no means. So, you know, America is, in a sense, a big society, meaning a lot of people with a lot of layers. Even though Americans do not see it this way, it is a class society, meaning, you know, various layers of both education and economic status. And the further west you go, with the exclusion of maybe San Francisco, which was settled to great extent by industrialists and was a financial center of the West, but the rest of the Western states, in exclusion of major cities, has been settled by people who obviously didn't bring much culture with them and that kind of carried on. And then obviously, as decades were going by throughout the 19th and 20th century, then obviously those cultures also were diverging. I mean, there was a Native American culture that was developing that was not necessarily based on anything with European or classical Western origins, but it was a local culture that took into account any folk art or any local ideas. It is actually fascinating to look, when you look at the history of art and American art, you can look at this kind of mutual feeding back and forth, because you would have American classic artists like Albert Bierstadt, for example, who was a German artist who came to United States. He loved the Californian nature and he painted Yosemite and Yellowstone, you know, beautiful national parks, in the style of the romantic German paintings of the 19th century. So you would have this. But then you would have someone like Copley, who would go from the during American Revolutionary War. He was from United States, but he didn't like the colonialism. He went to England and tried to make a career in England because he wanted the classical European art. That was what was more interesting to him than whatever was in locally. So you would see this kind of historical feeding back and forth. I think that's the beauty, that you have different continents and different cultures. But if we're talking about education, I think there is enough of the education or knowledge of art in sense of the popular art, you know. I don't know, the 20th century colorful art of you know, Haring of or Basquiat or you know, any pop culture images, because they permeate our culture all over the world as decorations of various tchotchkes that we have, and they are popular as shows, and they are on murals, and they are in the graphics and whatever. And I'm just saying that there's more art to, there's more to art than just pop culture. There's a pop art, there's other types of visual imagery that
Yeah.
is not embraced as much.
So what does that mean for the future with the rise of the Asian market, for example, the rise of the Chinese markets, who are swiftly becoming the number, well, they are currently the number two buyer in the international art markets. They beat the Brits and they're just second to the United States. But they are currently number two in terms of the amount of art that they buy and sell. And the Chinese art market, we discussed this briefly before the call, is one of the pockets where academic research finds a lot of very favorable risk-adjusted returns for investors. So what does that mean for the future? And should we all learn about Chinese art?
Well, I think we should always learn about Chinese art. There's 5,000 of Chinese history, and it's full of wonderful art. So that is completely misunderstood, or not completely, but not very well understood, or liked, or popular in the West. But that's no here, no there. In terms of China, you know, a country where there's about 100 million affluent people, which is a huge amount of people, basically. Potential buyers. There was a period in China when it opened up to the West, meaning post-Cultural Revolution. So let's say from 1980 forwards, there was a period where, when finally kind of collecting and being interested in culture after the Cultural Revolution, when that was completely annihilated. But there was a period where Chinese investors and collectors were interested in any Chinese artifacts because they wanted to, A, collect things that were all over the world because a lot of them have been destroyed during the Cultural Revolution or left the country. So there was a general trend that they were interested in collecting Chinese art that they could find in the West. That trend lasted till about the year 2000. For about a good 20, 25 years, that was the trend. Once that got saturated and settled, they started, and the new generation of Chinese people grew up who were able to study in the West. They kind of started opening up to the Western culture and Western art because they discovered it. And they started being interested in owning some of this art. This trend is still ongoing. I write about it a little bit in the article about Guo Pei, who is the fashion designer from Beijing, who started first making her designs kind of connected to the Chinese artifacts and culture and iconography, if you like. But then she went to the West, started discovering Louvre, started discovering Western art, and started incorporating that in her designs. So she's a very good example of someone who was originally inspired by the domestic art and later on became inspired by the Western art. And I think this trend is still continuing because now a lot of business people in China have also discovered that art, something that the Westerners have known for quite a long time, of course, that the art is a very good investment. But they started also appreciating. So I think that trend is continuing and will be continuing for quite a long time.
And the big auction houses, Sotheby's and Christie's, are, of course, playing into this hand by doing a lot of online sales, catering to the online public.
Well, then there is one more thing that I don't know if it exists in the Netherlands. You could look into this because it's kind of financially interesting. In France, you have the law that if there is a major work of art, let's say a painting by an impressionist, and that comes on the market, the government has the right to put a stop on exportation of this painting abroad, and it has to be purchased locally, meaning within France, and it cannot be exported. There is a painting by Gustave Caillebotte, who is one of the impressionists, that is a painting called the Boater, and that is a painting that came up onto a market in 2022. A family was selling it. The French government has intervened and put a label on it that this is part of the national heritage and it cannot be exported abroad. Wow. I think they may have been offered from, I don't know, Saudi Arabia, China, or any other place, but not France. But the government has not allowed it. So then what the Musée d'Orsay has done is that they found the funding. The funding was found through the conglomerate of Louis Vuitton. It's called LMVH or whatever. And they found the funds. And the painting has been purchased by Musée d'Orsay. It's one of the star paintings right now. I actually wrote an article about it. And I spoke to a curator from Musée d'Orsay a couple of weeks ago about the process. And we were just discussing just that the government has prevented that painting from disappearing from France. So what I'm saying is that this applies to France, that is very careful about preserving the heritage of that country. I don't know if that exists in the Netherlands, but I would be very sad to see that there is a major painting of the Dutch Baroque that is suddenly sold off to Australia, China, or Saudi Arabia, or whatever, leaving the Netherlands where it should stay. So you might want to look into this because it's an interesting aspect of education, finance, investment.
I will look into that.
And national heritage.
Yes. And it's a nice defense mechanism for preventing the red obsession scenario. Have you seen that documentary about the wine where all the Chinese buyers are just flooding the market in France? It's a great documentary. And that scenario could probably play out in this cultural field as well.
That's why I'm mentioning.
Yes.
But we have run out of time. I don't know if you realize.
We have.
We have to wrap it up.
So we should wrap up, Nina Hein. But it's been an absolute journey again. It's been a lot of fun. And I can't wait to tour around a museum with you again. So when is our next adventure? Maybe Poland.
I don't know. We could go anywhere you want. We can go to Rome. We can go to Warsaw. We can go to Valencia. You name it.
Well, that's a good thing about Europe. It's only a 2-hour flight away, and you're in all of the aforementioned. So
exactly.
Just tell me when and where, Nina, and I'll be your honored guest.
And we'll have another episode here.
That would be brilliant. Record. All right. Well, Nina Hein, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for making the time. And you really are a godsend with your wealth of knowledge about art and taking the time to teach a very uninformed individual like myself and fueling my love for the arts. And I hope to relay that gift to my children. And I hope that through this interview, we can motivate other parents and other people in a role of education to really teach the new generation and give that gift.
Yes, that's our fervent wish here. Thank you, sir, very much for having me.
Thank you, Nina.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.